about destroying Hamas. It is not about stopping rocket fire into Israel. It is not about achieving peace. The Israeli decision to rain death and destruction on Gaza, to use lethal weapons of the modern battlefield on a largely defenseless civilian population, is the final phase in the decades-long campaign to ethnically cleanse Palestinians. The assault on Gaza is about creating squalid, lawless, and impoverished ghettos in the West Bank and Gaza, where life for Palestinians will be barely sustainable. It is about building a series of ringed Palestinian enclaves where the Israeli military will have the ability to instantly shut off movement, food, medicine, and goods to perpetuate the misery. Privilege and power, especially military power, is a dangerous narcotic. Violence destroys those who bear the brunt of its force, but also those who try to use it to become gods. Israel uses sophisticated attack jets and naval vessels to bomb densely crowded refugee camps, schools, apartment blocks, mosques, and slums, to attack a population that has no air force, no air defense, no navy, no heavy weapons, no artillery units, no mechanized armor, no command and control, no army, and calls it a war. It is not a war. It is murder. Images of dead Palestinian children lined up as if asleep on the floor of the main hospital in Gaza are a metaphor for the future. Israel will, from now on, speak to the Palestinians in the language of death. Those who orchestrate such sieges do not grasp the terrible rage born of long humiliation, indiscriminate violence, and abuse. A father or a mother whose child dies because of a lack of vaccines or proper medical care does not forget. A boy whose ill grandmother dies while being detained at an Israeli checkpoint does not forget. Families who carry the broken bodies of their children to hospitals do not forget. All who endure humiliation, abuse, and the murder of those they love do not forget. This rage becomes a virus within those who eventually stumble out into the daylight. Is it any wonder that 71% of children interviewed at a school in Gaza recently said they wanted to be a martyr? The refusal by our political leaders, from Barack Obama to all but five members of Congress, to the major media, to speak out in defense of the rule of law and fundamental human rights, exposes our cowardice and our hypocrisy. The public debate about the Gaza attack engages in the absurd pretense that it is Israel, not the Palestinians, whose security and dignity is being threatened. This blind defense of Israeli brutality towards the Palestinians is a betrayal of the memory of all those killed in other genocides in other times. The lesson of the Holocaust is not that Jews are special. It is not that Jews are unique. It is not that Jews are eternal victims. The lesson of the Holocaust is that when you have the capacity to halt genocide, and you do not, no matter who carries out that genocide or who it is directed against, you are culpable. And we are very culpable. The F-16 fighter jets, the Apache attack helicopters, the 250-pound smart GBU-39 bombs are all part of the $3 billion military aid we give to Israel. Palestinians are being killed tonight with American-made weapons. But perhaps our callous indifference to human suffering is to be expected. We, after all, kill women and children on an even vaster scale in Iraq and Afghanistan.
For decades, Palestinians have enjoyed statelessness, occupation, dispossession, and a lack of basic rights, while Israel has steadily taken their land and denied their freedom. Holding the people of Gaza under a 7-year siege has only brought more suffering, not peace. The mothers and fathers, sons and daughters who've been killed are not numbers. They're not characters in a video game. Their deaths are not to be celebrated. Each one has a name, an age, a story.
Hamza Raid, 6 years old. Mariam, 50 years old. Zachariah, 10. Mahmoud Lufti. Anas, 10 years old. Ibrahim Ramadan, 10. Sami Naim, 1 year old. Elias Ibrahim, age 4. Mohammed, 6 years old. Sarah Omar, 8 years old. Yasmin, 4. Sarah Mohammed. Mohammed Azraf. Manar. Rizq Ahmed, Dina Rushdie, Hala Wishahi, Uda Alwaj, Anos, Suha, Khadiji, Aziza, Fida Rafiq, Khadra Alabd, Musa Habib, Hania Abdul, Nayasin, Dinia Mehdi, Ahmed Salem, Salima Hassan, Unidentified Child, Ismail Hala Akram, Marwa, 25, Asma, Hania, age 2, Ranim, age 18 months, Zainab, Yusuf, age 62, Atna Amira, Husam Ibrahim, Akram Mohammed, Suja Abu, Abdullah Mansour, Yasmin Mohammed, Najah Saad, Yasin Sobri, Amal Yusuf, Yasmin, Aishak, Nazma, Sawad Abdul, Mohammed, Sahirabu, Fatima, Basim, Siraj, Mohammed, 18 months. Mahmoud, 58. A succession of full names, if known, followed in most cases by their ages. Age 4. As a Palestinian, as an Israeli, as a Muslim, as a Jew, as a Christian, as a human being, as an athlete, as a Nobel Prize laureate, as a playwright, as a mother, as a rabbi, as a humanist, as a family, I choose love. I choose to raise my voice. I choose to speak truth. I stand for peace. I choose courage, equality. Stop bombing Palestine. I choose peace. I choose freedom for all. All signs being held up by individuals posing for these pictures. By the way, JVP asked you to submit your photo. Submit your photo to freedomforpalestine.org. freedomfor4palestine.org. Learn more at JVP and IMEU, Institute for Middle East Understanding. # Gaza names. All right. We finally got through that. Obviously, our show today is going to be all about Gaza. Again. How could it not be? There is so much more material here for me to pass along to you. Some of you are not going to like what you hear at all. Some of you may be even violently moved to want to do something to somehow turn me off, make sure others don't hear from me. My name, by the way, is Lawrence Tawil. I commonly go by Ren. This is the Mideast Migraine Show for Monday, July 28th, 2014, which comes to you by way of Free Radio Santa Cruz on our streaming service at freakradio.org, freakradio.org. Click on the red oval for the free streaming link. And, of course, we broadcast within the bounds, roughly, of the city of Santa Cruz, California at 101.3 FM. 101.3 FM. The phone number, by the way, directly to the studio here, I'm live and I am here in person. It's 3:20 p.m. this Monday, July 28th. And if that jives with your own personal time-space continuum, 3:20, July 28th, then you know that I'm live. So you can call me here in the studio. Area code 831-427-3772. Once more, and I will repeat the number oft times in the next hour and 40 minutes, roughly. Area code 831. That's the area code, of course, for Santa Cruz County, California. 427-3772. That's 427-3772. Let's begin with a Huffington Post article by the American Task Force on Palestine, authors Sarsar and Haikal. Huffington Post article, The Solution to Middle East Chaos. I see no date associated with. Let's just get into it. The solution to Middle East chaos. Aggression and war, insidiously and savagely, consume the hearts of humanity. Huge amounts of energy, ingenuity, resources, and sacrifice are continuously wasted as people fight in the name of freedom, self-defense, self-determination, God, righteous conquest, justice, national security, and power, typically to no avail. The specter of vicious but pointless conflict is today most evident in the Middle East, where extremism is on the rise and antagonisms are often fierce. Such dynamics make history, to paraphrase a line from James Joyce's Ulysses, such dynamics make history a nightmare from which we are trying to awake. The record of human suffering there is long, and in many ways it is getting worse. Gaza, Syria, and Iraq are pained by that same disease of extremism and conflict. Civilians, more specifically children and women, are bearing the brunt of the injustices. In today's Middle East, we have sacrificed a generation to the flames of rage. The ongoing hostilities between Hamas and Israel, the third outbreak of such violence since 2008, is tragic. Fear grips both Israelis and Palestinians as innocents die or are wounded, with the majority being the elderly, women, and children. The Palestinian death toll, as of July 23rd, 2014, 5 days ago, has reached over 680. That's just the death toll. 680. And the wounded more than 4,220. The United Nations Agency for Refugee and Welfare, UNRWA, UNRWA, says more than 100,000 Palestinians in Gaza are internally displaced. This is not to mention the destruction of homes, schools, hospitals, and basic infrastructure. Hamas and other militants in Gaza have fired over 2,160 rockets and other unguided projectiles into all parts of Israel and even some areas of the occupied West Bank. Unlike the Palestinian inhabitants in Gaza, most Israelis have the benefit of sirens, shelters, and the Iron Dome defense. Therefore, Israeli civilian casualties number just two, but with 32 soldiers killed as of this writing. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict demonstrates how much effort both sides have put into dehumanizing each other. Many Palestinians and Israelis have lost their empathy and trust. Both sides see themselves as perpetual victims and the other side as victimizers. Hatred is further entrenched through every eruption of the conflict. A far more bloody, although much more recent tragedy is happening in Syria as an outcome of its civil war. The government of President Bashar al-Assad, this is Syria we're talking about now, is responsible for most of the violence, as his forces have been fighting against various rebel groupings, many of which are also at odds with extremists of the Islamic State. According to the Washington Post, three Syrians become refugees abroad every minute. Eight children inside Syria are forced to flee their homes every 2 minutes. I'll say it again. Eight children every 2 minutes inside Syria are forced to flee their homes, on average, all numerically counted out. And one person dies every 10 minutes. The death toll in the three-year-old conflict in Syria stands at above 170,000. Millions more are refugees or internally displaced. A similar sectarian conflict is engulfing Iraq. So far in 2014 alone, violence there has killed more than 5,500 civilians. This year, more than 1.2 million Iraqis were also forced to leave their homes. The recent terrifying surge of Islamic State fighters and their allies out of Syria and sweeping through many Sunni areas of Iraq is taking place against a growing backdrop of anger against the sectarian policies of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Again, this is in Iraq. Kurdish groups appear to be moving closer to breaking away from Iraq as its Arab regions fragment along sectarian lines. There does not appear to be a sustainable balance between established authorities and opposition groups that can allow for regional stability. In the battle for ideas, power, and survival, force is being emphasized at the expense of human rights and the common good. My group or country, right or wrong, supersedes any other loyalty. A problematic issue is the ease with which aggression is initiated and violence committed. Even though international norms regarding the right to go to war, jus ad bellum, and the legitimate conduct in war, jus in bello, are extensive and well-established, the indiscriminate killing of innocents and non-combatants continues. Violations of the laws of war, international humanitarian law, and international human rights law are evident, but little is being done to address them. Even the mechanisms for such accountability are not in place. Ethics and diplomacy are dying on the altar of illusory and narrow-minded understandings of self-interest and power politics. Whatever the sources of our values may be, for example, God-given, the legacy of the Enlightenment, individual intuition or reason, folkways and mores, etc., we have an equal obligation toward all others, not only those similar to us or with whom we identify, yearning to eliminate, quote, the other, let alone actually doing so, is both illegal and immoral. It runs counter to our ethical, religious, and spiritual values. We have an obligation to move beyond violence. We must become part of a new culture of peace that celebrates people rather than dehumanizing and repressing them. This is an essential part of upholding the principle of compassion, which, according to the Charter for Compassion, and I quote, impels us to work tirelessly to alleviate the suffering of our fellow creatures, to dethrone ourselves from the center of our world and put another there, and to honor the inviolable sanctity of every single human being, treating everybody, without exception, with absolute justice, equity, and respect, end quote. Will the power of compassion and love ever replace the love of envy and power? If not, surely the dictates of genuine, rational self-interest demand an end to this chaos and bloodshed that costs everyone in the long run and benefits no one. Will human security be able to release itself from the clutch of brute force? Again, if compassion isn't sufficient to compel people to move beyond violence, surely the logic of self-protection must. As long as all we can rely on to secure our interests is violence, or what amounts to violence by other means, genuine security will be an illusion. We must recognize that our deepening interdependence has collapsed the boundaries between the logic of self-preservation and the logic of empathy. I'll read that again. We must recognize that our deepening interdependence has collapsed the boundaries between the logic of self-preservation and the logic of empathy. The latter, the logic of empathy, is still a higher and more noble value to be strived towards, but the former, the logic of self-preservation, in practice, leads us to a very similar place, moving past war and towards peace. If peace is our destination, then peace must be our path. The authors. Saliba Sarsar is professor of political science at Monmouth University and member of the board of directors of the American Task Force on Palestine. Tala Haikal is the youth outreach coordinator at the ATFP and tweets at Talamay, TALAMAY. The American Task Force on Palestine is headquartered with their offices in Washington, D.C. You know, it's easy for me to agree with all the sentiments in that article, But to be perfectly honest, I'm awfully tired of the oh-so-masterful arrangement of words and arguments that make for a high-sounding article. If I had read it first, I might not have begun my show with it. Let's try this one. Passed along to me by a friend, I do not know if she is the author or not, but it's not that long. I'll simply present it to you, entitled Israel, Aggressor or Victim? You have to admire how Israel changes its public image from aggressor to victim. Here are some points to consider. An opening statement for each paragraph, and then some comments. Israel has the right to defend. Again, Israel has the right to self-defense. So do Palestinians. Rockets fired from Gaza are crude, do little damage, and so far have killed only one person. And that, of course, is in reference to the current conflict, which began about 3 weeks ago. To stop the rockets and the blockade of Gaza. In fact, to bring about peace and the occupation of Palestine. Yes, I think this must have been written by my friend Margaret here. Next point of potential argument. Hamas won't accept a ceasefire, but demands preconditions. So does Israel. Hamas demands withdrawal of all Israeli troops and end of the blockade. This refers to the economic blockade by Israel over the Gaza Strip over the last 7 years, since 2007. Israel insists on continued occupation until all tunnels are destroyed. I think the Israeli people, claims Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, I think the Israeli people understand now what I always say, that there cannot be a situation under any agreement in which we relinquish security control of the territory west of the River Jordan. That there cannot be a situation under any agreement in which we relinquish security control of the territory west of the Jordan River. In other words, all of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Next point. Israel is threatened by Palestinians and surrounding Arab countries. Well, Israel is a major military power. Israel has the largest army in the Middle East, armed with high-tech weapons and an arsenal of nuclear bombs. The U.S. gives Israel $3 billion a year in military aid. The planes that drop bombs on Gaza are American F-16s, just one of the weapons paid for with American tax dollars. Palestinians don't have tanks, planes, artillery, etc. If Putin is to blame for arming the Russian-speaking separatists in the Ukraine, aren't we to blame for arming Israel? Margaret's last point here. Hamas uses civilian shields. Israel doesn't target civilians. Gaza is densely populated, 1.82 million people in a small area. Wherever arms are stored, they are probably near a populated area. By July 26, the 19th day of the current Israeli military operation in Gaza, there have been 3,175 buildings destroyed, 5 hospitals bombed, at least 4,620 people injured, including 1,358 children. More than 1,000 killed, including 258 children killed. 258. No Israeli children have been killed or injured in the present hostilities. I think it's extremely important to impress this upon people, so I'm going to read that entire last point again. Point of argument, Hamas uses civilian shields. Israel doesn't target civilians. Response, Gaza is densely populated, 1.82 million people, 1.82 million people in a small area. Wherever arms are stored, they are probably near a populated area. By July 26th, the 19th day of the current Israeli military operation in Gaza, that was 2 days ago, there have been 3,175 buildings destroyed, 5 hospitals bombed, at least 4,620 people injured, including 1,358 children, more than 1,000 killed total. By this point, 3 weeks into the conflict, more than 1,000 Palestinians killed, including 215 children. No Israeli children have been killed. No Israeli children have been injured in the present hostilities. And to reiterate, there have been one, maybe two civilians killed. I believe the official count is only one Israeli civilian killed by a rocket or in connection to a Hamas rocket, a Gazan rocket fired, and some, 35 Israeli military soldiers, warriors, killed. The part about wherever arms are stored in the Gaza Strip, they're probably near a populated area. My way of seeing this is, where do the Israelis store their bombs? I'll tell you where they store them. They store them under the wings of fighter jets and other, perhaps other aircraft that are more directly suited to bombing or firing missiles. Now, Israel stores their bombs on their military jets. The Palestinians in the Gaza Strip don't have any airplanes, let alone jet fighters. These Palestinians have no artillery. The Israelis store their artillery bombs near or in the barrels of cannons. Overall, Israel stores its bombs, its missiles, and its ammunition and explosives, initially anyway, in their military bases. For a country, for an area that has no official army, no navy, no air force, no artillery units, no tanks, no attack Apache helicopters, the Gazan Palestinians store their missiles where they can, obviously. And here Israel is criticizing these barbarian bastard Gazans, quote unquote, wherever you want to put those quotes, near civilians. The point here is, how could they not store them near civilians? Next item. I'm just going to play for you a section of a recent 1 or 2 day old presentation, I believe, of Amy Goodman's Democracy Now, entitled, "What Does Hamas Really Want?" Israeli journalist Gordian Levy on Ending the Crippling Blockade of Gaza. Let me read you the introductory remarks. And again, this is from www.democracynow.org. As the Israeli assault on Gaza enters its third week, a new push is underway for an internationally brokered ceasefire. Speaking earlier today, this was sent to me only yesterday, but that's just when it was sent to me. Speaking earlier today, Israeli Justice Minister Zippy Livni said there is, quote, no real hope, end quote, of an immediate halt to the fighting because Hamas conditions are too far from those of Israel, the United States, and Egypt. Hamas demands have centered on an end to the Israeli blockade of Gaza and the release of its prisoners. The 7-year siege crippled the economy, civilian infrastructure, and water supplies. In Gaza, unemployment tops 40%, 40, and almost 80% rely on humanitarian aid. The United Nations has warned Gaza. The United Nations has warned that Gaza will no longer be livable by the year 2020 unless urgent steps are taken. The last ceasefire in November 2012 was supposed to ease the blockade, but Israel only intensified it, with Hamas vowing to continue fighting against what it calls a, quote, slow death. A new ceasefire largely hinges on whether the United States and others will pressure Israel to reverse its stance. We are joined from Tel Aviv by Israeli journalist Gideon Levy. And I'm going to forego the few remarks that are written here. I believe they're actually just a repetition of what is said in the course of this this video and audio presentation here. It's coming right up.
This is democracy now.
Now. The war, the peace report, the new push on Israel, the international brokered ceasefire.
I've said many times, Israel has a right to defend itself against rocket and tunnel attacks from Hamas. And as a result of its operations, Israel has already done significant damage to Hamas's terrorist infrastructure in Gaza. I've also said, however, that we have serious concerns about the rising number of Palestinian civilian deaths and the loss of Israeli lives. And that is why it now has to be our focus and the focus of the international community to bring about a ceasefire that ends the fighting and that can stop the deaths of innocent civilians, both in Gaza and in Israel.
Speaking earlier today, Israeli Justice Minister Tzipi Livni said there is, quote, no real hope of an immediate ceasefire because Hamas's conditions are too far from those of Israel, the U.S., and Egypt. Hamas's demands have centered on an end to the Israeli blockade of Gaza and the release of its prisoners. This is Hamas deputy leader Ismail Haniyeh.
The demands of our people are clear. The aggression must be stopped, and a guarantee should be given it would not be repeated. The blockade must be lifted, this unjust blockade that our Palestinian people are living in.
The seven-year siege has crippled Gaza's economy, civilian infrastructure, and water supplies. Unemployment tops 40%, and almost 80% rely on humanitarian aid. The UN has warned Gaza could no longer be livable by 2020 unless urgent steps are taken. The last ceasefire in November 2012 was supposed to ease the blockade, but Israel only intensified it. With Hamas now vowing to continue fighting against what it calls a slow death, a new ceasefire largely hinges on whether the U.S. and others will pressure Israel to reverse its stance.
We're now joined by Israeli journalist Gideon Levy in Tel Aviv. In a piece for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, headlined, What Does Hamas Really Want?, Levy writes, quote, These conditions are civilian. The means of achieving them are military, violent, and criminal. But the bitter truth is that when Gaza is not firing rockets at Israel, nobody cares about it. Read the list of Hamas demands and judge honestly whether there's one unjust demand among them. Gideon Levy, welcome to Democracy Now! Why don't you lay out the premise of this piece, what you're trying to convey in your article in Haaretz?
Look, we tend to beat our enemies and never to listen to them. And many times, listening even to the enemy, even to the most bitter enemy, can serve much a better cause than beating and beating and beating. And unfortunately, Israel is just using their violence right now without listening to their conditions. I don't know if their conditions are acceptable. I don't know if those are really their conditions, but they say it very clearly. They ask for freedom for Gaza. They ask to lift the siege. Can you recall a more just require than this? But I'll say something more than this. Doesn't it serve the interests of Israel seeing Gaza free and seeing Gaza building its economy and not living in those unhuman conditions in the biggest cage in the world, which creates only more hatred and more violence. So it is really at our door now to decide, do we want to go from one cycle to the other, from one circle of bloodshed to the other, not solving anything, or are we willing once and for all to put a real just solution to the problem of Gaza?
Well, with the massive civilian toll in Gaza, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was asked Monday if he's worried about losing international opinion. Netanyahu was speaking to Brian Williams of NBC News.
You know, at a certain point, you say, what choice have you got? What would you do? What would you do if American cities, where you're sitting now, Brian, would be rocketed, would absorb hundreds of rockets? You know what would you'd say? You'd say to your leader, a man's got to do what a man's got to do, and you'd say, a country's got to do what a country's got to do. We have to defend ourselves. We try to do it with the minimum amount of force or with targeting military targets as best as we can, but we'll act to defend ourselves. No country can live like this.
That's Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking on Monday. Gideon Levy, so he's saying here that this current attack is about self-defense, and the blockade has been justified in terms of, well, we have to stop Hamas from smuggling rockets. They are, after all, a group that's committed to our destruction. Your response to that?
So did you stop the smuggling with the siege? Did you really stop? We see now how well-equipped Hamas is. This is ridiculous, because any siege can be broken for certain purposes, but the siege breaks the people of Gaza and pushes them again and again to the corner of violence and to the corner of desperation. But I would like also to comment about the Prime Minister's remarks as if Israel has to react. Sure, Israel has to react and has to defend itself. But Mr. Prime Minister, where did it start? Those rockets fall on our heads just by chance? There is no context to this. There was not the breaking of the political negotiations by the Israelis refusing to release some few veteran prisoners. There was not a war declared on Hamas in the West Bank after the kidnap and the murder of three Israeli youngsters, arresting 500 Hamas activists who were not involved in this kidnap. Didn't Israel stop the salaries, transferring the salaries to 40,000 Hamas workers, employees in Gaza? And what did Israel think? Wasn't Israel against the unity government? And what did Israel think? That all this will pass like nothing and Hamas will accept everything? So I have news. Those who believe that nothing will happen were either extremely arrogant or blind or both.
Can you explain, Gideon Levy, the feeling of Israelis, you're in Tel Aviv, we're about to be joined by a guest in Jerusalem, of the rocket fire that's coming from Gaza, the something like 2,000 rockets?
Look, I don't want to underestimate. It is certain fear, for sure, more in the south, close to the Gaza Strip. This morning there were two sirens in Tel Aviv, and 5 minutes later, life went back to its routine. I don't say that people don't carry some kind of fear, but by and large, the life, at least in the center, I've been yesterday to the south, the picture is different there. By and large, the life is more or less continuing with some changes. People go out less, but it's not the big fear of the horrible days of the Second Intifada with the exploding buses and suicide bombers. I don't even hint to say that this can become a routine. No way, it can't. But compared to the suffer of Gaza, this is really a children's game right now. And thanks God also, there are almost no civilian casualties in Israel. Having said this, I don't call for more casualties in Israel. I just say, Let's try and solve it once and for all and not go again to the old games, which had proven already that they lead to nowhere.
Again, democracynow.org.
Ooh,
that's loud. Okay. We'll put that one to sleep. Next item. Yeah, I'm still here, folks. I seem to have lost track of my home page. It seems that whenever you get that multiple feedback kind of gobbledygook echoing effect, when I, in the course of trying to salvage that situation, technically, the audio sound there, the bad audio, I wade through a lot of, you know, windows that pop up on your screen. You try to get rid of the extra ones, and I got rid of one too many, so I need to go to tune back into my... Okay. I was still signed into my Hotmail here, so simple situation to remedy. That was, you heard the voice of Gideon Levy, who is a regular columnist for Israel's leading periodical, Haaretz. Gideon Levy, and a little edification there for those who take it for granted that Israel is only going to have its most ardent proponents speaking on behalf of the newspaper and on behalf of Israel. Israel is a country with a great, a high degree of freedom of speech. Perfectly fine for it. It's true that probably not one Arab country can hold a candle to that particular aspect of Israeli freedom. You even hear Arabs in Israel with dissenting views. Through my experience, not many of those, or at least not many dissenters who write or speak out on tape, on video or on audio, with an Arabic sounding name. In fact, people who speak out, even despite Israel's tradition of free speech, of what we would refer to in the United States as First Amendment rights, having to do with our own Bill of Rights under the U.S. Constitution, in spite of that, there is such a thing as saying too much against the Israeli state, against Zionism, the project of Zionism, and those voices and those individuals tend to be quashed. It's true. All right. Let's take a slight break from that line of thinking and discussion. A slight break. On two days ago, on the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines, I do come to you twice a week, Saturdays at 11 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Saturdays at 11 a.m. and, of course, this Monday afternoon edition at 3 p.m. Both shows are about 2 hours long. I'm going to reread this one article written by Katie Zawadzki of the Daily Intelligencer, a New York periodical, July 25. It turns out Hamas didn't kidnap and kill the three Israeli teens after all. That's the title she gives that Katie Zavodsky gives this. It turns out Hamas didn't kidnap and kill the three Israeli teens after all. Instead, it was some guy acting as a rogue, quote, lone cell. When the bodies of three Israeli teenagers kidnapped in the West Bank were found late last month in June, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu did not mince words. Hamas is responsible, and Hamas will pay, he said, initiating a campaign that eventually escalated into the present conflict in the region, namely in Gaza, in the Gaza Strip. Kidnapped. But now, officials admit the kidnappings were not Hamas's handiwork after all. Non-plagiarizing BuzzFeed writer Shira Frankel was among the first to suggest that it was unlikely that Hamas was behind the deaths of Gilad Shar, Naftali Frankel. As far as I know, no relation to writer Shira Frankel, and Eyal Yifrak. Citing Palestinian sources and experts in the field, Shira Frankel reported that kidnapping three Israeli teens would be a foolish move for Hamas. International experts told her it was likely the work of a local group acting without concern for the repercussions. Here is a statement directly regarding that. Quote, quoting Gershon Baskin. I'm sorry, no. Here's the statement. Gershon Baskin pointed out that Hamas has earlier this month signed an agreement to form a unity government with Palestinian Authority Chairman Mahmoud Abbas, bridging, for the first time in 7 years, the Palestinian leadership in the West Bank and Gaza. Quote, they will lose the reconciliation agreement with Abbas if they do not take responsibility for the kidnappings, Baskin added. Today, she was proven right. Repeated inconsistencies in Israeli description of the situation have sparked debate over whether Israel wanted to provoke Hamas into a confrontation. Israeli intelligence is also said to have known that the boys were dead shortly after they disappeared, but to have maintained public optimism about their safe return in order to beef up support from the Jewish diaspora, the Jewish population around the world. Writing for Al Jazeera, Musa Al-Kharbi argued that Israel was deliberately provoking Hamas, saying this, all the illegal and immoral actions related to Operation Brother's Keeper were justified under the premise of finding and saving the missing teens, whom the Israeli government knew to be dead, cynically exploiting the tragedy to whip up public outcry in order to provoke and then confront Hamas. This pattern of deception continues under the ongoing military offensive in Gaza. For example, last week, in collaboration with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi and Abbas, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, in its efforts to alienate Hamas, Israel announced a bad faith ceasefire proposal which Hamas was not consulted on and never agreed to, but whose violation supposedly justified Israel's expansion and intensification of the military campaign into Gaza. End of statement. Despite continued negotiations, the violence shows no signs of letting up, and after Thursday night's massive protests in the West Bank, there is still no ceasefire agreement. On Friday, it became clear that U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's attempts to broker a 7-day truce were rejected by Israeli officials. Instead, Israel will apparently widen its ground operation in the Gaza Strip, its military army operation, despite international outcry about the civilian death toll. According to unnamed officials, the proposed truce was too generous to Hamas's demands. Hamas, meanwhile, still hasn't weighed in on the agreement, whose details are being kept secret, but continued to launch rockets into Israel. International peace talks are set to resume in France this weekend, and we're keeping our fingers crossed. Through Reuters BuzzFeed, again, reporting by Katie Zawadzki on the Daily Intelligencer. This was July 25, last Friday, 3 days ago. Now, folks, here's the thing. Since that report from 3 days ago, we have this, which I believe is slightly more recent. I just have to find it. There, it's right above it. This one, this little cocksucker, they're making me sign in again here. That's my own computer, computer browser program thingy here. I go into my high school typing mode, trying more or less to use all 10 fingers, or at least 8 of them. Not much faster, if faster at all. Keep me signed in, you little sucker there. Okay, let's try this again. This one is from OnDevice, and it's dated Saturday the 26th, a day later than the last one I wrote to you. From OnDevice, the war of ideas in the Middle East, well-known internet Middle Eastern news magazine. This is entitled, and pay close attention, folks. The title of this is, "The Claim That Hamas Killed 3 Teens in the West Bank is Turning Out to Be the WMD of the Gaza Onslaught." WMD, of course, standing for Weapons of Mass Destruction. You see where we're going? Claim that Hamas killed 3 teens is turning out to be the Weapons of Mass Destruction claim of the Gaza Onslaught. This comes to us by Adam Horowitz and Phil Weiss, July 26th, Saturday. Truth is famously the first casualty of war, and the Israeli war on Gaza is no exception. Yesterday, John Donison of the BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation, pulled the rug out from under the Israeli government's pretext for the Gaza onslaught with a series of tweets from Twitter about a conversation he'd had with Israeli police spokesman Mickey Rosenfeld about the kidnapping and murder of 3 Israeli teens in the West Bank in June. "The boys were not killed by Hamas," Rosenfeld told Donison as he reported on Twitter, saying this: "This version of events is so important because what the weapons of mass destruction, WMDs, were to the Iraq war," referring to George W. Bush's, Bush 43's, invasion of Iraq per se. "What the weapons of mass destruction were to the Iraq war, a dubious pretext, the 3 teens are to the Gaza onslaught. Let's review. The three teens were abducted on June 12th. That same day, Israeli authorities received a desperate phone call from one of the boys that contained gunfire at its conclusion. The supposition that the boys were dead was advanced when Israeli authorities found the car in which the abduction had taken place with evidence they'd been shot. The information about the gunshots on that desperate last phone call was widely known in the media. But, as we reported, the Israeli government issued a gag order against these facts being published. And over the last 2.5 weeks of June, the Israelis launched extensive raids across the West Bank, locking down Hebron, supposedly to find the boys. But the major focus of the raids was rooting out Hamas affiliates and arresting them. In fact, the purpose of the raid seemed to be to break up the recent unity government between Hamas and Fatah, which Israel has vigorously opposed. The boys' bodies were found on June 30 in a shallow grave in the West Bank. And again, the deaths were exploited to punish Hamas. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said then, Hamas is responsible, Hamas will pay. By June 16, Hamas increased rocket fire into Israel in response to the crackdown in the West Bank. Israel ramped up its attacks on Gaza, conducting 6 airstrikes that wounded 2. On July 7th, that was June 16, on July 7, 8 days after the teens' bodies were found, Israel launched Operation Protective Edge, and it has now killed about 900 people in Gaza, most of them civilians. As in the case of weapons of mass destruction, many observers and journalists never bought the Israeli story. I'll say it again. As in the case of weapons of mass destruction, vis-a-vis George W. Bush's attack against Iraq, many observers and journalists never bought the Israeli story. We didn't, writes Adam Horowitz and Phil Weiss. We didn't. Annie Robbins picked up reports that Israeli authorities believe that a rogue faction of Hamas was responsible for the killings weeks before Donison's tweets. On June 16, she reported Hamas's denial, calling the Israeli allegations stupid. Allison Dagher also reported as much. Max Fisher was on to the dishonest Israeli strategy at Vox, V-O-X. Now Rosenfeld's statement is going all over the world. Joseph Dana has been all over the revelation. Hamas did not kidnap the 3 Israeli teens. This piece and many others in the U.S. press could use a correction. So has Ayman Moyeldin, a reporter for NBC in the United States. Ayman Moyeldin saying the following. This would be an imp shift for Israel, which blamed Hamas entirely in justifying why it launched Gaza war. That somewhat abrupt sentence, again, is probably a tweet or maybe a text or something. This would be an imp. I suspect that means this would be an impossible shift for Israel, which blamed Hamas entirely in justifying why it launched the Gaza war. Or whatever else an imp shift means. Call me if you know what that means. Let's finish this here before I give out the number again. And New York Magazine is even more cynical about this matter than we are. From Katie Savatsky's story, the first one I read just before this one, Savatsky's story entitled, "It Turns Out Hamas Didn't Kidnap and Kill the 3 Israeli Teens After All." Here's a quote from that story. "Repeated inconsistencies in Israeli descriptions of the situation have sparked debate over whether Israel wanted to provoke Hamas into a confrontation. Israeli, in other words, to irk those who control the rocket fire from the Gaza Strip into firing those rockets." Continuing, "Israeli intelligence is also said to have known that the boys were dead shortly after they disappeared, but to have maintained public optimism about their safe return to beef up support from the Jewish diaspora." End of excerpt. As John Donison said, "We can only hope that the 3 teens' pretext is broadly examined, not just in Israeli and Palestinian public life, but in the American media. It is hardly the first time that a false story about endangered security has been used to justify Israeli violence. From the Levon affair in Egypt in the 1950s, to Moshe Dayan's confession about provoking Syrian attacks that were used to precipitate the Six-Day War." That would have been 1967. "The only good news is that many in the West are now seeing through the tactic and beginning to question the veracity of Israeli government sources. I'm going to read that entire paragraph again. As John Donison said, we can only hope that the three teens pretext is broadly examined, not just in Israeli and Palestinian public life, but in the American media. It is hardly the first time that a false story about endangered security has been used to justify Israeli violence, from the Lavon affair in Egypt in the 1950s to the late Moshe Dayan was a leading Israeli general in the 1956 and 67 wars, and he also eventually became, I believe, the Minister of Defense, to Moshe Dayan's confession about provoking Syrian attacks, that were used to precipitate the Six-Day War. The only good news is that many in the West are now seeing through the tactic and beginning to question the veracity of Israeli government sources. Here's that phone number to the studio here, area code 831-427-3772, area 831-427-3772. You know, folks, you can call in for any reason that is even remotely related to what I'm doing here now, remotely or very much related to the topic, to the subject matter at hand. Call me just to check in. Let me know that you're listening. I certainly will appreciate it. Whoops. This computer is acting so funny. It's making me seasick. Let's see what's happening. This being truly pirate-style underground community radio, in consistent non-compliance with the Federal Communications Commission's rules, which is to say, having as little or nothing to do as possible with the influence of corporations on American media, providing you with the truth as we see it, as we can gather it. I am here in this rather makeshift version of a studio, in this form of community radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz. And it's really, really hard to do some of this stuff. You know? All by myself here. Okay, it's 4:14 p.m. this Monday, July the 28th, 2014. Did you hear that, folks? 4:14 on July 28th, that means that I'm live. If that matches with your time-space reality here, let's have a short musical break. You can call in during the break, too. Thank you. we're back. Here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, and streaming live on our online radio service at freakradio.org. That's freak, F-R-E-A-K radio.org. Click on the red oval that you will find on the bottom of the main page. Click on the oval and you'll get a link to our streaming service. You have to do the rest to feed that into your speakers or headphones there in terms of an adjacent audio program. But the red oval is our link. It's your link to the service. Okay. That's a tad too loud. Just loud enough so I know that I'm on the air. This is the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Ren Tawil. I come at you every Monday at 3 p.m. on 101.3 FM and also every Saturday at 11 a.m. Saturday editions of Mideast Migraines are dedicated, as they have been since last November, to the reading of important current books, or perhaps slightly older than current books, about the Israel Palestine Arab situation. I, at the moment, am reading Congressman Paul Finley's 1985 publication, They Dare to Speak Out. People and Institutions, the subtitle is People and Institutions Confront Israel's Lobby. They Dare to Speak Out. I read from the third edition, published some 11 years ago. Utterly fascinating material. Last Saturday, 2 days ago, I began reading Chapter 7, which is all about Israel's deliberate and sustained air and sea attack on a United States naval espionage vessel, an electronic surveillance vessel, they like to call it, the USS Liberty, in the June War of 1967. Many Israelis, including many American Jews, still want you to believe that the whole thing was an accident, that this was not a deliberate attempt. I have seen people to this day trying to maintain that it was a mistake. Well, if you had heard my broadcast on Saturday as I read most of Chapter 7, didn't quite have enough time to finish it, you will see how and why this attack was a deliberate action on the part of the Israeli military, an apparent attempt to sink the vessel. I won't go into that now. You'll have to, if you either pick up a copy of that book, Paul Finley's They Dare to Speak Out, initially published 1985. It's going back a bit of a ways, but it's available. They Dare to Speak Out. Pick up a copy, read Chapter 7, entitled The Assault on Assault. The second usage of the word assault, referring to another book entitled Assault on the Liberty, which was written by a Mr. Ennis Jr., who was the Navy officer of the deck the day that the attack occurred. He wrote the book. He also helped put together the website, which has been maintained and contributed by other surviving members of that crew, and exists, the USS Liberty website exists today. So you can read the book, or you can go to the following website, radioforall.net, and go to the archives for Mideast Migraines. That's two letter I's in the word migraines, MIGRAINES, Mideast Migraines. Find it at radioforall.net, and that's radio, the number 4, ALL.NET, radioforall.net is where you'll find the archives for my recorded episodes of Mideast Migraines, both Saturday and Monday editions. And look up Chapter 7, although I think I just uploaded that today. It's just look for TDT SO, short for They Dare to Speak Out, the Assault on Assault. And you may hear my reading of all but the last half dozen or so pages of that chapter. I will, of course, complete the chapter on Saturday. And you read that chapter, or you listen to that recording, and you try to tell me that Israel is somehow morally and ethically above the kind of stuff that I've been reading to you today. It strongly insinuates that Israel is fully capable of and culpable of pursuing and perpetrating. You put it together, folks. By the way, in case it hasn't occurred to you, I think I know what some of you might guess that I'm about to say. Oh, I know, you're an anti-Semite, right? No, I state here and now unequivocally, I am not anti-Semitic. I do not hate Jews. I find nothing about the Jewish faith or the Jewish tradition or Jewish people which inherently or intrinsically causes them to be evil or causes them to try to fool people or causes them to try to take over other people's land. There's a thing called Zionism. It is a political movement, not a theocratic movement based in the Judaic tradition. They may say it's based in Judaic tradition, but Zionism is a political monstrosity which has taken the desire of some people of the Jewish faith to want to reestablish a national home for the Jewish people, for any Jew who lives anywhere in the world, only they've done so in a land which undeniably is the historical root geography of the Jewish people, but they completely avoid the fact, ignore the fact, or try not to think about the fact that there are people who have lived there continuously for many, many hundreds of years. In fact, as far as I'm concerned, if you are speaking in terms of genes and chromosomes, the Arabs who lived there, going before the time of Muhammad, before the advent of the word Arab or Arabic, or even before the modern Arabic language as it is used today, the Arabic people, as they are called now, go back at least as far as the ancient Hebrew people, the Hebrews being the predecessors, shall we say, of today's Jews. They're just as old, if not older, because there were people living in Canaan, which is what they called Palestine. Before it was called Palestine, before it was called Israel, it was Canaan. It had other names, I'm sure, more localized, now largely forgotten names. And they were there before the Hebrews entered the land of milk and honey. So anyway, my point is, who am I? I am not an anti-Semite. I am a non-Zionist, virulently anti-political Zionist who happens to be of the Palestinian extraction. My father and his family, his immediate family, were born and raised in Jerusalem in what was then generally referred to as Palestine, not only by the British or the Ottoman Turks, but by the Palestinians themselves. They use the word too, believe it or not. My father proudly proclaimed that he was Palestinian. I can remember him using the word many, many times. And I heard the pride in his voice when he said, Palestine, I am from Palestine, when he spoke to his friends who came to visit the house or wherever we were. This is my dad talking. He was a Christian. I grew up in the Lutheran Church here in California. I'm born and raised in the San Francisco Bay Area. But my dad was Palestinian from Jerusalem. He became a de facto displaced person when he could not return to his homeland, his home, his property, and his family in May of 1948 when Israel came into being and they legally canceled his British-issued passport. He couldn't go nowhere. He couldn't leave the U.S., so he met and married my American mother. They had four children. I'm the second born. The other three, well, what can I say? They're all girls. Get with it, Ren, here. Come on. Don't go there. That's who I am. I am of Palestinian extraction, which does not by any means mean that I have to hate Jews. To get my message across, hate is not necessarily, only a willingness to provide my side of the story. That's what this is about. That's what I'm about. Now I'm going to read this to you. By the way, it's 4:31 p.m. I got a couple of important articles, important items to read to you. This one is submitted by Amina Saleem. Actually, on June 17th. Amina Saleem, June 17th, entitled International Media Ignore Israel's Abduction of Palestinian Teens. Again, international media ignore Israel's abduction of Palestinian teens. And there's a full-color picture here of an Israeli soldier's raiding a Palestinian home in the town of Halhul near the occupied West Bank city of Hebron. 16 June, the soldier's face is conveniently, for his sake, obscured by a piece of canvas while he is in the process of apparently gagging or blindfolding, probably blindfolding, and is Palestinian youth who is sitting and squatting, already has his hands tied with the plastic wrist wraps here. Okay, here's the article by Amina Saleem. In the first 10 days of June, 17 teenage boys were abducted in the occupied West Bank. The youngest was 13, the oldest 17. Some were dragged at gunpoint from their homes. Some were dragged at gunpoint from their homes and family in the middle of the night. Others were seized from the street in broad daylight. All of the abductions were documented by the Palestinian Monitoring Group. None were reported by the international media. No Western politicians called for the release of the boys. On 12 June, three more teenage boys went missing in the West Bank. Their disappearance sparked worldwide media coverage, cries of terrorism, and demands for their release by the U.S. Secretary of State and the United Kingdom Foreign Secretary. Those three were Israeli. The 17 others are Palestinian. And if the case of Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, taken by Palestinian forces in Gaza in 2006 and released in 2011, is any indication, Western interest in the case of these three Israelis will not wane until they are found. Subheading, Black Hole. Conversely, the 17 Palestinian boys seized by heavily armed Israeli soldiers will disappear into the same silent black hole as all the other Palestinian children taken on an almost daily basis by the occupation forces. Very old news, folks. Some will be detained for days, weeks, or months, beaten, interrogated, and then released. Others, however young, will find themselves put through Israel's military courts and jailed, often on the basis of coerced confessions. According to the rights group Adamir, there are currently approximately 200 Palestinian children being held in Israeli jails. Some of those children will suffer periods in solitary confinement. All are at risk of physical abuse amounting to torture. If their plight is anything to go by, the 17 Palestinian youngsters taken by the Israeli army at the beginning of June will merit not a word spoken or written about them by the same journalists now eager to tell the world about the disappearance of three Israeli teenagers. Obviously, this article was written and released before their bodies were found. Continuing, if children and teenagers disappear in the West Bank as a result of the occupation, it should be reported, whether those youngsters are Palestinian or Israeli. But in the highly selective Western media reporting on Israel's occupation, Israeli suffering always trumps that of Palestinians. Since the disappearance of the three Israelis last week, the Palestinian town of Hebron has been held under siege by the Israeli army. Up to 1,000 soldiers have been going door to door in towns and refugee camps across the West Bank searching and ransacking civilian homes. 200 Palestinians have been taken into detention. A 20-year-old Palestinian has been shot dead, and the Israeli government has been threatening the forcible transfer of some West Bank Palestinians to Gaza for supporting Hamas. I remind everyone, all of the events presented in this now old article, recently old article, occurred before Israel's current invasion of the Gaza Strip. They occurred before Israel's invasion of Gaza. Continuing with this this item. This is the degree of control that Israel exerts over Palestinian lives. But that control seems to be so accepted or ignored by Western media that there has been next to no comment on Israel's actions and the illegality of them over the last 5 days. The sole focus is on the Israeli teenagers, with scarce journalistic attention left over for the collective punishment being meted out to thousands of Palestinians by a country which calls itself democratic. New subheading, No Palestinian Mothers. The case illustrates starkly the difference in the attitude of Western media towards Israelis and Palestinians, an attitude exemplified by the BBC. BBC News bulletins have carried regular updates on the missing Israelis and backed them up with online stories. In one online article headlined, Israel accuses Hamas of abducting missing teenagers, an embedded video features the mother of one of the Israelis talking about her wish for his safe return. While BBC audiences have been made well aware of his situation and that of his two friends, they remain in the dark about the Palestinian children and teenagers regularly abducted by Israeli soldiers. BBC reporting also shields them from the frequency with which Palestinian children and youth are killed by Israeli forces. There were no BBC reports on the killing of 14-year-old Youssef Shawamri, shot in the back and hip while gathering thistles in March, or of 18-year-old Saji Darwish, shot in the head as he tended his goats that same month. The killing of 7-year-old Ali Al-Awar in an Israeli missile strike on Gaza. Pardon me. The killing of 7-year-old Ali Al-Awar in an Israeli missile strike on Gaza last week also fails to warrant a report. There are no embedded video interviews with the mothers of Youssef, Saji, or Ali mourning the permanent loss of their sons. In response to questioning by Palestine Solidarity Campaign about the failure to report on the killing of Palestinian children by Israeli forces, the BBC responded this way, quote, there is no mandate to report every killing, end quote. Would BBC editors have felt the same way if 7-year-old and 14-year-old Israeli children had been killed by Palestinians? Subheading, Media's Cloak of Silence. The last few days have highlighted the extremely narrow framework, not just of the BBC's reporting on the occupation, but of the Western mainstream media as a whole. More than 5,000 Palestinians are currently held in Israeli jails. All the children and the adults. More than 5,000 Palestinians currently held in Israeli jails, where torture has been documented by organizations including Amnesty International. Approximately 200 are incarcerated without ever having been charged or tried for a crime, for indefinite periods of time under a system known as administrative detention, according to Adamir, the human rights group. And more than 200 have been on hunger strike since April in protest of Israel's use of administrative detention. The BBC's response to the mass hunger strike, now in its second month, and Israel's attempts to rush through legislation allowing force feeding, has been silence. The same silence cloaks house demolitions. 15,000 Palestinian homes demolished by Israel since 1993. And I want to add to that close to 30,000 Palestinian homes demolished since 1967. Continuing, the destruction of entire communities, with Palestinian villages being bulldozed both in the West Bank and within present-day Israel. The killing of Palestinian children, 1,405 killed by Israel since 2000. Children. The denial of sufficient water for drinking, washing, cooking to Palestinians in both Gaza and the West Bank. And the true effects on the siege of Gaza, which denies Palestinians everything from essential medicines to electricity. The list goes on and on. How many consumers of mainstream news reports in the West know any of this? How many know that Israel's apartheid wall in the West Bank is more than twice as high and four times as long as the Berlin Wall, and that we all in the twice as high and four times as long as the Berlin Wall that we all in the West were taught to loathe? How many know that the Palestinians had their country seized from them in 1948, that Israel was created on that stolen land? And the total lack of justice or reparations since then, 1948, coupled with ongoing brutal military occupation, has led to this present situation. The number will be as limited as the mainstream news reporting that keeps them in the dark. Their lack of knowledge will display in a total lack of understanding of Israel's occupation and its devastating impact on every aspect of Palestinian life. These are the audiences created by Western mainstream journalists, with the kind of selective reporting we've witnessed this week, audiences whose ignorance can only be to the detriment of Palestinians and to the benefit of Israel. Again, that article, waiting patiently for it to return, was written by Amina Salim. I apologize for not knowing the conduit for that article, who picked it up and who carried it. Amina Salim. Now, as the show comes to a close, I'm going to begin reading a remarkable item called Update from the Holy Land, July 2014, appears to be a monthly thing. Copyright Reverend Kate Tabor. Update from the Holy Land, Kate Tabor's blog, I guess. Listen closely, folks. This is an excellent climax to today's show, although there's only roughly 10 minutes left in today's show. Myths and Misperceptions. Responding to Common Arguments Supporting Israel's Operation Against Gaza. If you've ever wondered how anyone can possibly make an argument to stand up against what Israel is doing, supposedly for Israel's own security and benefit, listen up. Myths and Misperceptions, Responding to Common Arguments Supporting Israel's Operation Against Gaza. Number one, here's the statement. Gaza is no longer an occupied territory, but an independently operating entity. Israel disengaged from its occupation of Gaza in 2005 when it removed its settlers, thus removing its obligations as an occupying force. Supposedly, here's the response. Underlined and in bold letters, Israel maintains, quote-unquote, effective control of the Gaza Strip, and by that definition is still occupying it and still responsible under international law for the safety and welfare of its inhabitants. Israel did indeed remove 8,000 settlers from the Gaza Strip in 2005 and replaced them and more in the West Bank in Jerusalem. They moved the settlers from the Gaza Strip to the West Bank anyway and to East Jerusalem, where the number now exceeds 600,000. Removing its civilians from the Gaza Strip made it easier for Israel to exert military and economic control over Gaza without risk to its own citizens. Gaza continues to be occupied in accordance with international law and in the views of the international community, including the United States, the European Union, and the United Nations. I will read that again. This is extremely important. The Gaza Strip continues to be occupied in accordance with international law, which is to say, as occupation is defined by international law, and in the views of the international community, including the U.S., the EU, and the UN. The laws of occupation apply if a state has, quote-unquote, effective control over the territory in question. This effective control consists of Israel's control of Gaza's borders, airspace, territorial waters, population registry, currency, the movement of people, trade, electrical supply, water supply, fuel supply, medicine supply, electromagnetic sphere, the tax system, and more. Further, Israel maintains and exerts a right to conduct regular military operations in Gaza, including invasions, the declaration of, quote, no-go buffer zones where anyone who enters can be shot, arresting Palestinians living in Gaza and imprisoning them in Israel, and more, giving Israel effective military control over the territory. For these reasons, Gaza is not a sovereign territory and remains under occupation by Israel. As occupier, Israel has certain responsibilities under international law for the civilians living in its occupied territory, including the responsibility for their safety and welfare. Furthermore, even if Gaza's status as occupied was in question, international humanitarian law includes clear protections for civilians during an armed conflict, including the responsibility to protect the wounded, sick, children under age 15, and pregnant women, enable the free passage of medicines and essential foodstuffs, enable medical teams to provide assistance, and refrain from imposing collective punishment. Myth and or misperception number two. How can Israel be expected to negotiate with a terrorist group that won't recognize its right to exist, Israel's right to exist, as part of its organizing charter? Hamas wants to push Israel into the sea. Here's the response. Hamas's charter is unforgivably racist and violent. Yet, since moving into Palestinian politics in 2005 and 2006, Hamas has changed its rhetoric and tactics to an important degree, accepting a Palestinian state within the 1967 borders. Hamas' charter was written in 1988, 26 years ago. It is deploringly anti-Semitic, religiously fanatical, and violent. They admit that here. However, since that time, Hamas decided to enter the political arena and as a political party promoting a campaign platform and pursuing political agendas, they began to change their tone and tactics. They reigned in violence, including suicide bombings. Their language and agenda, this is since 1988, their language and agenda became less focused on religious fundamentalism and more on international law. Hamas officials have made public statements in contradiction to the charter, even specifying that they do not have problems with Jews, but rather with those who attack and oppress. Officials have repeatedly and recently affirmed their acceptance of a state in the West Bank and Gaza. That is to say, Gazan officials, or Hamas officials, have affirmed their acceptance of a state in the West Bank and Gaza, Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. Continuing, in 2006, Hamas was elected through a democratic process, which the international community welcomed, paid for, monitored, and declared to be in accordance with international standards. Yet, attempts by Hamas to establish diplomatic relations with the EU or America have been rebuffed, responding that Hamas must accept the, quote, quartet principles, the set of three requirements laid out by the Quartet on the Middle East for the diplomatic recognition of a Palestinian government. These conditions include recognizing the State of Israel, abiding by previous agreements between Israel and the PLO, and renouncing violence. While Hamas itself has not made a declaration specifically accepting these conditions, they did agree to allow the formation of a new Palestinian government in June, with the Fatah president as the head. That was, of course, this year, 2014. That government has agreed to accept the Quartet principles. Thus, if Israel genuinely wanted peace and a partner with whom to negotiate, it would be in their best interest to support the new Palestinian unity government. Hamas's changes in no way excuse their charter, and they are certainly not a justification for attacks against civilians. Nevertheless, they do indicate that Hamas is a pragmatic organization whose views on the conflict have evolved together with other Palestinian factions. Well, okay, my friends, I'll read one more of these and then it'll be time to close out for the day. Myth or misperception number three. Israel has a right to self-defense. No country would allow rockets to rain down on it from across its borders. What would you do if Mexico sent rockets across our borders? Response. This claim ignores Israel's responsibility under international law for the safety and welfare of Gaza's inhabitants. The historical context of Gaza's refugee problem and current humanitarian crisis under Israel's siege, the right of Palestinians to self-defense, and equates the occupied territory of Gaza with a foreign sovereign nation. This claim has four problems. The first is that it ignores Israel's obligations under international law. As explained in the first section, Israel has a responsibility for the safety and welfare of civilians living in its occupied territories. An occupying power cannot justify military force as self-defense in territory for which it is responsible as the occupant. The second problem is that it ignores the context. Some two-thirds of the Gaza Strip's population are refugees. Two-thirds of them, expelled from their homes, mostly from the 1947 to 49 during the war that established the State of Israel, with another sizable group arriving in 1967 during the Six-Day War when Israel occupied the West Bank and Gaza. Movement of goods and people has been restricted for decades. The Israeli military has invaded, raided, shelled, shot, demolished homes and more in Gaza. Israel imposed sanctions after the 2006 elections, and Gaza has been under siege ever since. Jewish Voice for Peace describes the siege this way, quote, Israel controls the airspace, waters, and borders of Gaza, with the exception of Rafah, the border with Egypt. Israel controls the electrical and sewage infrastructure of Gaza and how much food, fuel, and other supplies can arrive and leave, giving it almost total control over the economy. Palestinians in Gaza do not have the freedom to leave at will, to visit relatives in the West Bank, or get adequate health care. 1.8 million Palestinians are crammed into 140 square miles, making it one of the most crowded places on earth. Israeli restrictions have exacerbated a deep economic recession and high unemployment, leading to extremely high poverty rates. Basic supplies and medicine are restricted, while safe drinking water is scarce. End quote. The JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace, quote. This denial of human rights and the maintenance of miserable living conditions is the context in which rockets are fired from Gaza. The third problem is related to the second. The claim implies equivalence between the two entities, as if Gaza is a sovereign foreign state attacking another sovereign state. As has already been illustrated, Gaza is not sovereign, but occupied. As an occupied territory, it is not simply a foreign entity to Israel. Rather, it is territory Israel took control of and is now responsible for. The Mexico-U.S. metaphor, aforementioned metaphor, is not appropriate. The fourth problem with this claim is that it ignores the right of Palestinians to self-defense. I'll say it again. The fourth problem with this claim is that it ignores the right of Palestinians to self-defense. How often do we hear about Israel's right to protect itself, to defend itself? Continuing here. International law grants a people fighting an illegal occupation the right to use force to end their occupation, and the occupied, and I quote, are entitled to seek and receive support, end quote. That's according to United Nations Resolution 2908 and 2625. Palestinians have the legal right to resist occupation and pursue sovereignty, even with violence, provided that they do not target Israeli civilians. Okay, folks, obviously you have your answers to some of the things that I said, but if you really heard the entire blog that I just read to you, not to mention everything else that I've been reading to you over the past 2 hours, your work is cut out for you. Okay, this is the end of the Monday edition of Mideast Migraines on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Thank you for joining me. I'll be here next Monday at 3 p.m. Don't forget the continued reading, closing pages of the chapter involving Israel's deliberate attempt to sink a United States naval vessel in 1967. That'll be Saturday at 11 in the morning, Pacific Daylight Time. Please consider donating to Free Radio Santa Cruz. We need a new place to move our studio to so we can operate on a more fiscally sane basis here. We are once again, as we have for several months, almost continuously on air, on the airwaves, in addition to our online service. We want to maintain that and go successfully into our 20th year of operation, having been continuously liberating the airwaves since 1995. Thank you and goodbye.